broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Your spiky hair won't wound enemies. Piercing all of your body parts won't release pain. No one will notice next week. Pain mangles your kidneys despite your vodka drownings. It crayolas a soul quicker than needles tattoo flesh. Pain sparks a bonfire. Your purest weed can't compete. She laces her high-heeled boots with your guts. Your most skilled lover cannot untie the damage. A household of guilt is easy to award, but that's not my job. I could lull you to sleep with Chaucer, but that's not my job. I could stroke your hand and hear you for once, but that's not my job. You slid into my seating chart, this bloodied, cynical facts of a child, and I must teach you. Hell, there's no Mother Teresa in me, certainly no Helen Keller in you. And yet, here we are. It's you, me, Macbeth, and Grendel. Pull your foggy brain up off that desk. Pay some respect to the woman I'll become when I ease my way around your landmines and reach your mind.
The Child Left Behind by Dana Kinsey, published in the Broadkill Review and read by Linda Blasky. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The September-October issue of the Broadkill Review, one of the significant literary journals published in the Mid-Atlantic region, reached readers this week. In addition to its normal nonfiction, poetry, fiction, and book review offerings, this issue is featuring a fiction genre called speculative fiction, or spec fic, as it's also known. If this is a new literary term for you, as it was for me, we're fortunate to have Scott Whitaker, managing editor of the Broadkill Review, with us today to discuss the review's take on the genre. In addition, Christopher Weston is with us to discuss his speculative fiction short story, Ordovicia. And as you heard at the opening of the program, the Broadkill Review also publishes excellent poetry, and we're fortunate to have poet Catherine Gecker with us to read and discuss a number of her poems published in the current issue of the Broadkill Review. And last, but by no means least, the review's poetry editor, Linda Blasky, is also with us to discuss the poetry she is looking for to be published in the review. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank
Thanks.
You. Thank you.
Linda and Scott, let me begin with you. Tell us about the Broadkill Review. Give us a bit of its history and how it came about, as well as its primary purpose as a literary review. Linda, why don't we begin with you?
Well, the Broadkill Review was started by Jamie Brown, and he started it because he thought there was room in the Mid-Atlantic region for a literary review, and he wanted to publish a review that sparked conversation. The first issue came out in January of 2007. It was 24 pages long, and it had 5 people on its editorial advisory board, and none of us were given any distinction at all. It was published in PDF form. in July of 2016, we were forced into a temporary hiatus. And the last PDF issue before we went into that hiatus was 102 pages long. It had three editors that were given distinction, the poetry editor, the book review editor, things like that, and 15 contributing editors, one of which lives in Australia, Marianne Kahn. She's our Australian and South Pacific editor, and Katie Matsuga is our European editor and is based in Paris.
What's the purpose of the review? What are you looking to accomplish with the review?
As Jamie, what he wanted to do was to publish a journal that sparked conversation between writers and readers. We wanted to find some of the best poetry, nonfiction, fiction that we could and put it out there for people to read.
Well, you mentioned in the review that it has a new home. It's an online journal. What's the new home that you have found for it?
Well, instead of being a PDF journal, which would arrive in your email and you would download it to your computer, now you go to the, I think it's just broadkillreview.com, and there it is online. It's right there.
So tell us again how our listeners can find the Broadkill Review.
Broadkillreview.com.
So that's all they need.
That's
all they need. www.broadkillreview.com.
Yep.
Okay,
that's it.
Very good. Scott,
yes,
you have an essay, I think an excellent essay in this issue of the review, the new home issue, as it were. By the way, when I received it, I have to say I found it very, very convenient to use. In fact, a little easier than the last one that I received from its old home, and it was easy, frankly, to navigate around among the authors and among the poetry and the short stories and the essays. So that looks like it might work out fairly well.
I hope so.
For you. You were involved in setting up the quote, new home?
Yes. I wanted to keep the same look that the Broadkill Review had come to be known for, the kind of the journal newspaper almost aspect of the PDF magazine. So I looked long and hard for a proper web template for an online issue that would not only mimic what the readers have come to see in the Broadkill Review, but also make it easier for them to share it with their loved ones, with their readers, and as well on social media. So much of the business today is generated by social media contacts. It's a lot harder to do that with a PDF journal. You have to download it. You have to take screenshots. You have to excerpt things. With a strictly online format, it's a lot easier for reviewers to publish or to promote the reviews that we have published in the magazine. For instance, if a book reviewer is looking, oh, hey, this is, you know, we really like to get this review out, it's a lot easier for them to share it and a lot easier for the readers to pick up on it and hopefully share it with their friends and family, as well as their readers or their students or whatever the case may be in terms of readership. We just want it to be a seamless process, one that was not dictated by downloads. We had a lot of problem when people would not download the issue right away. I know Jamie spent a lot of time resubmitting links and resubmitting the downloads, and that became very cumbersome towards the end. And we just hope this is a seamless, easy process for readers to find us, read what they like, and go about their day.
Well, I as I said, I found it easier to navigate in. Quite frankly, I think a little easier on the eye.
Mm, okay.
As well, the print, it was, I think, fairly easy to take. Is it shorter? Was this issue a little shorter than what I have normally seen, or is that just an illusion of mine?
It's almost an illusion. What I've done with the online ones is I've put all the documents into one Word document to kind of gauge the length. And I have been surprised that we're still clocking in close to 100 pages with the web issue. It's the way it's laid out. It just doesn't seem as much. Take, for instance, a reader who's only interested in poetry. They don't have to page through short stories or reviews. They can jump right into the poetry and skip what they're not necessarily interested in.
Well, you start off on the home page, as it were, with an essay. And you introduced at least to me the term speculative fiction, and I have to confess I had not heard that term before. But I did do a little research, and I checked out that the fact that you are not the only one who knows what speculative fiction is, and I found it quite interesting to read about speculative fiction. But I have a few questions for you about it, because I was confused.
Sure.
To some degree. So tell us, Scott, what speculative fiction is.
Okay, well, it's a really broad umbrella term. It's almost a non-term. It's so general, it almost serves no purpose, really, when we say spec fic. It's almost too big. But the idea is that in speculative fiction, and this is really driven by the market, is they use this umbrella term so that they can get readers who are not only interested, say, in something as general as, say, Harry Potter. We have young readers reading all these fantasy stories, and as they get older, they're looking for work that is similar to what they grew up on. So the market has taken notice of this. They've adopted this term, speculative fiction, which is really just kind of an Americanization of magical realism. If you know that particular literary term, most of American speculative fiction either is one variation of kind of European surrealism or Latin American magical realism, or perhaps a fantasy or science fiction. It's any work that contains elements that are not necessarily bound by normal physical laws. That could be something as simple as a ghost that lurks about the pages of the story, or it could be something where you have maybe a magical place that serves some sort of symbolic gesture in the story, if you will. But this is a speculative fiction, really, is what most of, when we think of American letters, a lot of what we think about really is speculative fiction. Nathaniel Hawthorne, for example, or Edgar Allan Poe. They were writing stories of the supernatural, which fit well into the speculative fiction genre. And they withhold, you know, they'll still stand up today, of course. So this is a genre that you could argue that is one of the oldest types of literature. If you go back to like a campfire story, you know, that primitive people might have been telling around the campfire, or a religious ritual, or a magical ritual, or a myth. These are all speculative stories wondering, what if, or how did this come to be? And so speculative fiction is this huge, almost weighty term that can describe anything from a horror story to a campfire story to a story that has science fiction elements to a story that looks at an alternative America. You know, we hear that alt phrase thrown about a lot since the election. And in a lot of writers, they like to take a look at America and say, well, all right, what would happen if this were true? And they create an alternate timeline in which that story exists so they can explore either just a standard story, say a coming-of-age story, or they can use it to explore whatever political ideology they may feel needs to be addressed in their work.
Well, Scott, looking about after I discovered your term, I found Annie Neugbauer.
Oh, yes.
And read her piece on speculative fiction, and she kind of indicates that speculative fiction encompasses all of what she calls fantasy.
That's correct.
The fantasy genre. And then she suggests that it incorporates parts, but not all necessarily, of historical fiction, horror fiction, and science fiction. Yes. And they kind of come together in what she calls, anyway, speculative fiction. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, it is. I think, you know, a lot of folks, I think science fiction and horror fiction, those genre tags, if you will, kind of get a bad name. We immediately think of something unwieldy or not lyrical or not beautiful, something that is perhaps not really concerned with writing beautiful language, but rather space guns or technology. And I think part of what the market has done is adopted this very general term to kind of soften those old ideas we may have about science fiction, rolling their eyes and thinking, here's going to be a bunch of unpronounceable names and a story that I cannot relate to because it's all going to be driven by technology or adventure or some sort of pulp type of fiction. And when you say speculative fiction, well, it allows for a lot of different things to get under that umbrella. And we don't necessarily rear back so much with perhaps some prejudice we might have towards genre fiction. Generally speaking, the Broadkill Review doesn't look for genre fiction. We're looking for the best stories written in the best way. I felt like we had a lot of regional writers who write speculative fiction. So I was like, well, you know, maybe we should focus on this. It's fall, you know, it's near Halloween. It's a good time to focus on something like that, you know, and also to try to draw in young readers or new readers. We have so, you know, where I teach at the high school, so many kids are reading. I mean, that's all they read is speculative fiction, and they devour it. Like, it's amazing. It's so great to see kids involved just reading book after book. And these books are thick, 1,000-page novels that are being cranked out, that they digest, put away, grab another, digest them, put away, grab another. I mean, it's great. And of course, the Broadkill Review is always trying to grow its audience. And one way to do that is to try to seek out some new voices in what may sound like a new genre, but really is been around all along.
From a writer's point of view, Scott.
Sure.
What does in this instance, speculative fiction? What does the term speculative mean? I mean, if you're a writer and you want to write speculative fiction, what are you doing? I'm looking almost for a psychological approach here. But okay. how does the term speculative apply to this genre?
The whole speculative fiction, or the speculation part, the what if, is the big hook for so many of the writers. Well, what if this were to happen in the United States? Let's take The Handmaid's Tale, for example, by Margaret Atwood. That is a classic. Now, when that book was published, it was not called speculative fiction. I think it was simply marketed as a science fiction or a general fiction novel. As it continues to grow in its austerity, that novel has become almost a hallmark example of speculative fiction, because she is going, well, what would happen if an extreme religious group took over the United States? What would that look like? And she designed that book. If you haven't read it in a while, it's almost a mock book. It's a mock archive book.
And it was a television.
And it's become a television show that's very popular. And it's an artifact from the future that someone finds. And there's commentary at the end that's also fiction, but it reads like commentary. So if you're a writer and you're looking for speculative fiction, you're looking to try to, well, Poe would examine the madness, the dark side, the imp of the perverse. He would take a look on that dark side of himself and go, well, what would happen if I engaged this part of my heart? How would that play out in this murder story or in this ghost story? Hawthorne was played with the same ideas. He perhaps used was perhaps a little more speculative because he used a little more supernatural events than Poe, who focused, say, mostly on murders and the mind. These days, like Stephen King, he's always, his most of his work is kind of horror fiction, but as he's gotten older, it's mellowed out some, so to speak, and he's often marketed as a general speculative fiction tale. What the writer likes to do, I think what the big draw for a writer is that world building. That's a kind of a tag term you hear a lot with writers. Oh, the world building part. Getting into the details of what this new world could be, looks like, tastes like, smells like, what are the politics there? How does that all function? How, as a writer, can you make those little setting details a larger character? And it often reminds me of William Faulkner, actually, you know, who really created this wonderful, rich world down in Mississippi. And that world was itself this beautiful character in his stories. And that same, that could also be applied to Stephen King, because all of his stories take place in this one part of Maine. And all those settings together almost act like a character. The writers I talk to who write speculative fiction are drawn to creating their own little small microcosm of a world and controlling all those details.
Well, one of the things that Annie Neugbauer says, though, in her definition of speculative fiction, is that the world that's built does not follow the laws of physics.
Correct.
That we experience them. Now, Faulkner's world follows the laws
yes.
of physics.
Yes,
the Bridesmaid's Tale follows the laws of physics. And the politics, the culture, those are different. So she then, it seems to me, has designed a much narrower sense of what speculative fiction might be.
Sure. There's usually some kind of non-natural, maybe it's supernatural, maybe it's a byproduct of some other force that plays out in these speculative fiction tales. And it doesn't always have to be so pronounced or so over the top or Hollywood. Oftentimes in some of the better stories, it's very subdued. You almost don't even notice it because the characterization and the plot and the writing is so beautiful that those details don't so necessarily pay or too much attention to. I'm thinking of George Martin now, or George R.R. Martin, the Game of Thrones writer. Those books are huge. They're popular. I mean, and also mean they're huge as in their many pages, thousands of pages each. But also the language is so absolutely exquisite sometimes. I mean, there'd be paragraphs where he's just describing the landscape, and it's poetry, really. And you forget that there's dragons or there's demons or some other science fiction element or fantasy element that's coming down the pike because you're so focused on this beautiful language and the characterization and the rich details of the setting, you kind of forget. You get lost. And I think that's a huge part of the appeal is the escapism that we find in these kind of stories and tales. And it reaches out into the broader popular culture with video games, comic books, and all that kind of thing.
Escapism
yes.
is a... It is a whole psychological discussion in literature that we could do we read literature to escape, or do we read literature to broaden our understanding
yeah.
of ourselves and the world we live in, or do we do both? Well, Catherine Gecker is with us today, Catherine Gecker writes poetry, and her poetry is not speculative fiction. It may well be speculative, but it is not speculative fiction. And as far as I could determine, it follows the laws of physics that all of us understand and experience. Catherine, tell us a bit about yourself, and then we want to ask you to read and talk to us about a couple of your poems.
Well, thank you, Hal. I'm very happy to be here today and very happy to be here as part of the Broadkill Review new launch. Thank you for choosing my poems, Linda and Scott, for publishing them.
Thank you.
I think ever since I was quite young, I've loved images, words, language, rhythms, sounds. Since I was in my early teens, I've been writing poems with a fair amount of attention, wanting to understand and learn the craft. So I've been writing for 50-plus years. I have been very happy to have my first complete collection of poems accepted for publication, and all four poems in the Broadkill Review are in that collection.
And what's the name of your collection, and when is it coming out?
It will be published in late 2018 or early 2019 by Glasslyer Press, and the title is In Search of Warm Breathing Things.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of your poems, Near Meander River, I believe, near Miletus. Would you read that poem for us and then tell us a little bit about it?
I'd be happy to. Near Meander River, near Miletus. A blue tiller's curved prongs rust toward red in some farmer's abandoned field. One beetle crawls along a scarred furrow, a doughboy in a trench. No way to turn around, no way to climb out, the only way forward. Each step limits the next step's choice, or expands it. Temple or field, fallen columns and ruined gods. These are and are not dialectics here in Meander's alluvium. Ruins surround us. Thin dogs prowl a barren tourist stop. It's oranges, warm coke, no temptation. For the first time in my life, I part my hair on the left, stumble past myself, unrecognizable in mirrors. No one here knows me, including me. I need to lie in wait to see myself. One coriander and cumin-stained chickpea lies on the ancient soil. If I were hungrier, I would pick it up.
What's going on in this poem?
The poem is about displacement, I think. The kinds of displacement, both physical, mental, psychological, we feel when we travel. And that many of us feel all the time, or often. We create new selves all the time. We'll try out a new word or a new way of speaking. And I think back in high school, today I'll go to school and be this way. The way we want to recreate ourselves, reimagine ourselves. And yet we always come back and meet ourselves somehow. And so travel allows us to escape that old self that was back home and perhaps not have any of the knowledge about us that the new people we meet will have.
Well, there are a number of lovely lines, and the images are wonderful. The beetle and in the furrow and a doughboy in a trench. No way to turn around. That's a very, very moving, image. No way to climb out. But the line that struck me out of that, the only way forward. And there could be an is in there, if I'm reading it correctly. There is no way but forward. You don't go back. Is that the sense of what you're after?
Yes.
In that particular section of the poem.
Yes, and I didn't want to use the to be verb is. I wanted it to be implied because I felt it would take away some power. It's a very
absolutely
unpowerful verb.
Absolutely, it is, and it's not needed.
Thank you.
No, exactly. The other line, which is almost profound, the other little section, is each step limits the next step's choice. Or
expands
it.
Yes.
Yeah. What? I have my sense. You've keyed all kind of philosophical concepts on time and motion and where we're going in life with that simple little line. What were you after with that line?
Exactly what you just said, Hal. Thank you for understanding that. The last 10, 15 years, I've attempted to write poems that keep going deeper, that deal with ideas, but I don't think poems of ideas work so well.
No.
So to tie them to a narrative, I like telling stories in the poems, and to tie them to images, I think, is the way to perhaps convey some of those ideas.
Yeah. Well, the other line, which I think is... It is quite significant in this poem. No one here knows me, including me. I need to lie in wait to see myself. What's going on with this with this line? I mean, I could tell you what I think is going on.
I'm tempted to throw it back to you since you did so well on the previous one.
No. I'm the host here. I get to ask the question.
Oh, shucks. I think it does go back to that sense of displacement.
Yeah.
That sense of how did I end up in this field in Miletus, which doesn't exist anymore either, nor does the Meander River exist anymore. And do I still exist if I'm in a place where no one knows me? Do I even know myself? So I think I was trying to capture that sense of lostness.
There's also a sense of reflection here that we think we know who we are sometimes, but what happens in our actions and what happens in our movements is that all of a sudden something comes by and we realize that it's us and we didn't even know that this is what we've become, that this is what. And so when you're perceptive, when you think about these things and open yourself to these things, you can, in fact, lie in wait and wait for yourself to go by again.
Perhaps it is a form of a speculative self.
I might ask you to talk a little bit more about a speculative self, but I want you to read another poem, if you would. How about Inside a Coffee Shop?
Inside a coffee shop. I see your face reflect away from mine in the window. At last night's dinner, you never once looked at me. Finished, you folded your napkin exactly at its creases, shrugged, said, "Well." My knee jiggles under the table. I am almost as angry as that man whose book I just read. Stairway to Heaven repeats a third time. How do we keep arriving at the same place? Outside, light shifts, blazes. Seven steel stabils rise, fall, yet remain on the same plane. Infinite loops rotate. Shapes like open palms say hello, goodbye. Sit down, be quiet.
Well, you know the question already. What's going on in this coffee shop? I'm this image of this woman sitting across from this man in this coffee shop. What's going on with her? What's going on between the two of them? Because you start off by talking about the two of them.
Yes. Let me approach the question a slightly different way. I think some of the most interesting, appalling sometimes, times in our lives are when things are ending. Relationships, either through death, illness, moving, divorce, just a relationship ending. And this poem started with me sitting in a coffee shop and noticing some steel stabils rotating outside. And I loved the image. So often a poem will start with an image for me. But how to make a poem interesting, because images in and of themselves are not that interesting, or at least perhaps they aren't that interesting anymore. The Romantics did nature so well. Can we do it still? We can't, probably. So I like to tell stories. And my story may or may not be very interesting, but if I can perhaps show a story that many of us have had, which is the ending of something that we counted on and the pain of that, then that would work. I like to use the I pronoun because I think it makes it more relatable, more believable, but much of my poetry is fiction. So I tried to think, how can I make these stabils come alive? They're rooted in the ground, and yet they're constantly changing. And that is similar to our lives. At some level, we're rooted, even though sometimes we feel quite displaced. And I know I'm using that word a lot today, but that's how it feels to me. And those times of displacement are the most interesting times in our lives. Perhaps not interesting in an attractive way, but they are sometimes painful, interesting.
Narrative poetry is generally very, very accessible. Even the really great narrative poems are at least accessible. You can follow them. You're not reading a puzzle, or you're not or there's not a trick somewhere in it that only six other people know. But you talk about telling a story, and that's narrative. Both of these poems are in fact narratives. They tell a story, as you say. But I get the sense that they are, and I know I've used this word a few times, I'll use it again, they are almost psychological narratives. They're a journey. They're a story, but they're a story about an emotion or about something that is developing. And as reading it, it's then developing within the reader. So the coffee shop and the stabils are infinite loops, and life is the narrative, that's the psychological story, these infinite loops that we go through, and they come to us in shapes that in fact do say, hello, sit down, be quiet, and very often goodbye. Let me ask you, Linda. Why did you choose these poems for the Broadkill Review? Why did you publish these poems? What were you looking for?
Well, when I look at poems, I'm looking for a sound, the use of sound and rhythm and flow. And that is apparent right off the bat from the beginning in Catherine's poems. I also look for a freshness, and I look for surprise. I mean, who refers to a beetle as a doughboy? And how often do you hear the word alluvium in a poem? Seven steel stables. I mean, there was so much in these poems that I found attractive, but I think probably the most important thing was after I read them and I put them down and I walked away, they sat on my shoulders for a little while and I carried them around and they talked to me. And I think that's probably the main reason. Mm-hmm. I said, let's do it.
Well, they're wonderful. They're wonderful poems. And to some degree, speculative from a psychological point of view.
Yes, thank you.
But let's come back to fiction, and let's come back to speculative fiction, if we can. And Christopher Weston has a story that I can see could be called speculative fiction in the Broadkill Review, Ordovicia. And Christopher, tell us first of all a little bit about yourself, and then have I pronounced the title of your short story correctly?
Thank you, Hal. I pronounce it Ordovicia, much like the Ordovician period in history or prehistory.
Okay, so you've got the soft C.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I grew up in Maine and started writing from an early age. I attended Emerson College in Boston, and after that, I traveled in Europe and in the United States. I find myself back here in Maine, writing and trying to stay creative and working with the food, as you may infer from the story.
Well, tell us about your story, Ordovicia. Tell us about the story, and tell us how the story, from at least your perspective, fits in the broad genre of speculative fiction.
Well, the inception of Ordovicia came about first by looking at the Ordovician period. And the Ordovician period is a time when the dominant life form called ammonites, a cephalopod, ruled the earth. Now, the name, the Ordovicia, was taken from a Celtic tribe that lived not far from the coast. They were eventually conquered by the Romans, who had a superior technology to them. So in speculating on what if we bring these things together, what if these things, instead of happening at desperate times, happen at the same time? And then going from there, extrapolating from that point to come up with a story, to come up with a premise that might grab you, or something that might challenge what you're thinking about.
Well, give us a little bit of that story. You're holding out on us here, Christopher. Tell us a little bit about this world that you have created, and a little bit about this this young woman that you have introduced us to in your story?
So the Wolin culture in the story is conquered. It is taken over by the Avancadre, and in doing so, they've come to eradicate the culture of the Wolin people and supply their own culture for their own needs. Wendy, the main character, is the daughter of Jasper, who was a child at the time of this invasion, this takeover. She is immersed in a culture that is not of her parents and her parents' parents. So she's facing a path that has no guidance, no ancestral guidance. You know, she is faced with decisions, opportunities, and has to make the best of the situation she's placed in. She's still very much a girl of her age as she matures through the piece and is susceptible to all of those things that go along with being a young woman.
Well, one of the things that interested me is that the Wolins have somewhat accepted their fate here as a conquered people. And then I have one other question about that. But am I correct there? There seems to be an acquiescence by the Wolins to this to the state that they're in.
I don't think that they're really left with much choice. Their possible means for defiance can't be violent. You know, they don't have the resources to supplant their oppressors. They are in a place and making the best of it. They are prisoners in their own home, in a way. But their oppressors are not sadistic. They have a purpose. They have a purpose for the Wolin people beyond what the Wolin people would have ever imagined for themselves. It may be the purpose of the Avancadre, but it's still a high purpose.
But do they know that at this early stage of the story?
You know, I think some of the Wolin people may be happy with their lot in life. Other people are not, much like our culture today. You know, a lot of people call for a revolution in any culture. This culture is no different. You know, we saw, you know, fruit vendors in Tunisia, you know, crazed by bureaucracy and stuff like that. There are people who will always, you know, rebuff the system. But the system, you know, cannot be toppled easily. So the means to topple the system, the lack of means to topple the system, leave them to accept their lot in life.
So I'm assuming, even though I didn't see any in the story, there are no rebel groups of Wolins.
There are no rebel groups of Wolin. There's no organized resistance with the Wolin.
Right. Well, they got... Let me ask you, Christopher. One of the ways in which they are controlled is that for the men, the thumbs of their which hand is it? The left hand. Their thumbs are cut off.
Yes.
And why is that? Why is that as a way of controlling the society?
Part of the reason the Avancadre have removed the thumbs of the children of the people they've conquered is for penance. Even when Rome conquered another culture, they exacted some toll on the warriors that fought against them. Now, as we saw in with Roman culture, those cultures were eventually integrated into the Roman culture. The other thing is in separating a group from their culture, the Avancadre have seen that by removing the thumb, they will not be able to use the tools of their parents. They will not be able to mount an insurrection with this handicap.
So they removed the thumb of one hand. Is that,
yes.
Did I read correctly? Yeah, and,
yes.
and that was the left hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the men or the boys that grow into men are still able to be productive, but they're faced with challenges. And those challenges are physical in nature in a lot of ways. But they also are walking with a reminder on their hand, or the lack of the thumb, that constantly reminds them that they were conquered.
There is something about a pouch that one of the characters is so careful with. Tell what is in that pouch?
The pouch is carried by Wendy's mother, and the pouch contains the ashes of her father. He has passed away, and the normal cultural the cultural norms of his generation would have him buried where he was born, where he grew up, and that is simply not permissible by the Avancadre. So Breeze needs to take covert action to deliver her father to his final resting place, which is the ruins of the village she grew up in.
So she's carrying him in this pouch. Is cremation the normal way of disposal of the dead in this culture?
I think that the Wolin probably would just bury a person, but the Avancadre, a more advanced society, probably see cremation as the way to go. Every culture has these differences in their death rituals, and of course, being part of the oppressed culture of the Wolin, they wouldn't want to flaunt any of their cultural norms in the face of what the Avancadre dictate.
I got the sense that there is nothing, there's a lot odd in the story, different from our culture and so forth. But I didn't get the sense that there's anything supernatural or outside what is even evolutionarily possible here. Am I accurate in that? And in that sense, this would not be speculative from that sense, would it?
I don't believe it would be speculative from a supernatural perspective.
Right.
It's speculative in that we're bringing together cultures that don't exist, cultures that are very diverse in their evolutionary, technological levels. And we're seeing here, you know, the science of one culture dominating a culture that isn't that advanced.
Well, Wendy is a very, very bright young lady, and she is taken to the primary area where the avant-cadre are. Why is she taken there? What's happening here?
What we're seeing is the avant-cadre use or take the gift of the Wolin people. They are wonderful gardeners. They're great at growing crops. They are known for their ability to breed different strains of plants. And we're seeing them take that feature in the form of Wendy out of the Wolin culture and apply that feature to their own gold.
Christopher, a very, very interesting story you've created here, a strange world, but a world that's readable, and if you have any sense of evolution, a world that is graspable in that sense. What are you, as a writer, what are you trying, or what are you telling us with this story? Why is the story important to you?
Thank you for the compliment. Why is the story important? The story is important in the general terms of speculative fiction because it gets us outside of our held values and in a more analytical space to reflect on another culture or the trials and tribulations of another culture. Some may read the story and see reflections of their own culture, and they can contemplate that without challenging their personal beliefs about the culture they live in. So I'd like to think that it's an opportunity for some people to step outside of their held cultural beliefs and have hopefully an entertaining moment and reflect on some of the cultural norms that they haven't really analyzed, that they've been handed by others.
Let me come back. We've got a few minutes left here. Let me come back to Scott and ask you a version of really the same question on speculative fiction. Why is speculative, and I'm thinking now of the narrower definition, okay, of speculative, the supernatural, the world that has a different physics than ours, for instance, rather than just a different culture. What do we get out of that? What does that tell us? Why is that important? You're going to use that in another issue, next year's issue, as well. So clearly, for the Broadkill Review, it's an important genre. Hmm. So why is it important?
Well, that's a really good question. I think, well, I had an answer. Now I'm going to see if I can extrapolate that answer from my mind. When I think Christopher really kind of nailed it there a little bit, where it's very safe for us to look at something that's happening in a make-believe world. And I use that term very broadly, where physics don't necessarily apply. And we can see something that may be in ourselves or in our own culture that we may not be so comfortable with. But it's very easy for us to take a look at it in a speculative story and go, I don't like this. I don't like this. This makes me uncomfortable. This is very disturbing. I hope this does not come true. And it becomes almost a diagnostic tool for us to discern what is and what is not important in terms of values, history, culture, and our relationships to other people. I think it offers us that opportunity wrapped in a nice candy wrapper of an entertaining tale that is also hopefully very well written and constructed and crafted.
Well, Scott Whitaker, Linda Blasky, Catherine Gecker, and Christopher Weston, thank you all for this wonderful discussion of the Broadkill review, and particularly for Catherine, your poetry, and Christopher for your short story, and Scott for your elucidation of what speculative fiction is. I hope we've all learned something from this. And thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.